The eight women present, including Nora, exactly five had been invited to her Christmas parties in the past. Three had not, and at the moment those three looked for a hole to crawl into, as did Nora. "You crude little snot," thought Nora, but she managed to say quickly, "Afraid not, we're taking a year off." To which she wanted to add, "And if we ever have another party, Claudia dear, don't hold your breath waiting for an invitation." "I heard you're taking a cruise," said Jane, one of the three excluded, trying to reroute the conversation. "We are, leaving Christmas Day, in fact." "So you're just eliminating Christmas altogether?" asked Beth, another casual acquaintance, who got invited each year only because her husband's firm did business with Wiley and Beck. "Everything," Nora said aggressively as her stomach tightened. "That's a good way to save money," said Lila, the biggest bitch of the bunch. Her emphasis on the word money implied that perhaps things were a bit tight around the Crank household. Nora's cheeks began to burn. Lila's husband was a pediatrician. Luther knew for a fact that they were heavily in debt. Big house, big cars, country clubs. Earned a lot, spent even more. Thinking of Luther, where was he in these awful moments? Why was she taking the brunt of his harebrained scheme? Why was she on the front lines while he sat smugly in his quiet office dealing with people who either worked for him or were afraid of him? It was a good old boy club, Wiley and Beck, a bunch of stuffy, tight-fisted accountants who were probably toasting Luther for his bravery in avoiding Christmas and saving a few bucks. If his defiance could become a trend anywhere, it was certainly in the accounting profession. Here she was, getting scorched again, while Luther was safely at work, probably playing the hero. Women handled Christmas, not men. They shopped and decorated and cooked, planned parties and sent cards and fretted over things the men never thought about. Why exactly was Luther so keen on dodging Christmas when he put so little effort into it? Nora fumed but held her fire. No sense starting an all-girl rumble at the Center for Battered Women. Someone mentioned adjournment, and Nora was the first out of the room. She fumed even more as she drove home. Unpleasant thoughts about Lila and her comment about money. Even uglier thoughts about her husband and his selfishness. She was sorely tempted to cave right then. Go on a spree and have the house decorated by the time he got home. She could have a tree up in 2 hours. It wasn't too late to plan her party. Frohmeyer would be happy to take care of their Frosty, cut back on the gifts and a few other things, and they would still save enough to pay for the cruise. She turned on to Hemlock, and of course the first thing she noticed was the fact that only one house had no snowman on the roof. Leave it to Luther. Their pretty two-story brick home standing alone, as if the Cranks were Hindus or Buddhists, some strain that didn't believe in Christmas. She stood in her living room and looked out the front window, directly through the spot where their beautiful tree always stood, and for the first time Nora was struck with how cold and undecorated her house was. She bit her lip and went for the phone, but Luther had stepped out for a sandwich. In the stack of mail she'd retrieved from the box, between two envelopes containing holiday cards, she saw something that stopped her cold. Airmail from Peru. Spanish words stamped on the front. Nora sat down and tore it open. It was two pages of Blair's lovely handwriting, and the words were precious. She was having a great time in the wilds of Peru. Couldn't be better living with an Indian tribe that had been around for several thousand years. They were very poor, according to our standards, but healthy and happy. The children were at first very distant, but they had come around, wanting to learn. Blair rambled on a bit about the children. She was living in a grass hut with Stacy, her new friend from Utah. Two other Peace Corps volunteers lived nearby. The Corps had started the small school 4 years earlier. Anyway, she was healthy and well-fed, no dreaded diseases or deadly animals had been spotted, and the work was challenging. The last paragraph was the jolt of fortitude that Nora so desperately needed. It read, "I know it will be difficult not having me there for Christmas, but please don't be sad. My children know nothing of Christmas. They have so little and want so little. It makes me feel guilty for the mindless materialism of our culture. There are no calendars here, and no clocks, so I doubt if I'll even know when it comes and goes. Besides, we can catch up next year, can't we?" Such a smart girl. Nora read it again and was suddenly filled with pride, not only for raising such a wise and mature daughter, but also for her own decision to forego, at least for a year, the mindless materialism of our culture. She called Luther again and read him the letter. Monday night at the mall. Not Luther's favorite place, but he sensed Nora needed a night out. They had dinner in a fake pub on one end, then fought through the masses to get to the other, where a star-filled romantic comedy was opening at the multiplex. $8 a ticket, for what Luther knew would be another dull 2 hours of overpaid clowns giggling their way through a subliterate plot. But anyway, Nora loved the movies, and he tagged along to keep peace. Despite the crowds, the cinema was deserted, and this thrilled Luther when he realized that everybody else was out there shopping. He settled low in his seat with his popcorn and went to sleep. He awoke with an elbow in his ribs. "You're snoring," Nora hissed at him. "Who cares? The place is empty." "Hush up, Luther." He watched the movie, but after 5 minutes, it had enough. "I'll be back," he whispered, and left. He'd rather fight through the mob and get stepped on than watch such foolishness. He rode the escalator to the upper level, where he leaned on the rail and watched the chaos below. The Santa was holding court on his throne, and the line was moving very slowly. Over at the ice rink, the music blared from scratchy speakers while kids in elf costumes skated around some stuffed creature that appeared to be a reindeer. Every parent watched through the lens of a video camera. Weary shoppers trudged along, lugging shopping bags, bumping into others, fighting with their children. Luther had never felt prouder. Across the way, he saw a new sporting goods store. He strolled over, noticing through the window that there was a crowd inside and certainly not enough cashiers. He was just browsing, though. He found the snorkel gear in the back, a rather slim selection, but it was December. The swimsuits were of the Speedo variety, breathtakingly narrow all the way around and designed solely for Olympic swimmers under the age of 20. More of a pouch than a garment. He was afraid to touch them. He'd get himself a catalog and shop from the safety of his home. As he left the store, an argument was raging at a checkout, something about a layaway that got lost. What fools. He bought himself a fat-free yogurt and killed time strolling along the upper concourse, smiling smugly at the harried souls burning their way through their paychecks. He stopped and gawked at a life-size poster of a gorgeous young thing in a string bikini, her skin perfectly tanned. She was inviting him to step inside a small salon called Tans Forever. Luther glanced around as if it were an adult bookstore, then ducked inside where Daisy was waiting behind a magazine. Her brown face forced a smile and seemed to crack along the forehead and around the eyes. Her teeth had been whitened, her hair lightened, her skin darkened, and for a second Luther wondered what she looked like before the project. Not surprisingly, Daisy said it was the best time of the year to purchase a package. Their Christmas special was 12 sessions for $60. Only one session every other day, 15 minutes at first, but working up to a max of 25. When the package was over, Luther would be superbly tanned and certainly prepared for anything the Caribbean sun could throw at him. He followed her a few steps to a row of booths, flimsy little rooms with a tanning bed each and not much else. They were now featuring state-of-the-art FX2000 bronze mats, straight from Sweden, as if the Swedes knew everything about sunbathing. At first glance, the bronze mat horrified Luther. Daisy explained that you simply undressed, yes, everything, she purred, slid into the unit, and pulled the top down in a manner that reminded Luther of a waffle iron. Cook for 15 or 20 minutes, a timer goes off, get up, get dressed, nothing to it. How much do you sweat? Luther asked, struggling with the image of himself lying completely exposed while 80 lamps baked all parts of his body. She explained that things got warm. Once done, you simply wiped off your bronze mat with a spray and paper towels, and things were suitable for the next guy. Skin cancer? He inquired. She offered a phony laugh. No way. Perhaps with the older units before they perfected the technology to virtually eliminate ultraviolet rays and such. The new bronze mats were actually safer than the sun itself. She'd been tanning for 11 years. And your skin looks like burnt cowhide, Luther mused to himself. He signed up for 2 packages for $120. He left the salon with the determination to get himself tanned, however uncomfortable it would be, and he chuckled at the thought of Nora stripping down behind paper-thin walls and inserting herself into the bronze mat. 7. The officer's name was Celino, and he came around every year. He was portly, wore no gun or vest, no mace or nightstick, no flashlight or silver bullets, no handcuffs or radio, none of the mandatory gadgetry that his brethren love to affix to their belts and bodies. Celino looked bad in his uniform, but he'd been looking bad for so long that no one cared. He patrolled the southeast, the neighborhoods around Hemlock, the affluent suburbs where the only crime was an occasional stolen bike or a speeding car. Celino's partner for the evening was a beefy, lock-jawed young lad with a roll of muscle bulging from the collar of his navy shirt. Treen was his name, and Treen wore every device and doohickey that Celino did not. When Luther saw them through the blinds on his front door, standing there pressing his doorbell, he instantly thought of Frohmeyer. Frohmeyer could summon the police to Hemlock faster than the chief himself. He opened the door, made the obligatory hellos and good evenings, then asked them to step inside. He didn't want them inside, but he knew they would not leave until they completed the ritual. Treen was grasping a plain white tube that held the calendar. Nora, who just seconds ago had been watching television with her husband, had suddenly vanished, though Luther knew she was just beyond the French doors, hiding in the kitchen, missing not a word. Celino did all the talking. Luther figured this was because his hulking partner probably possessed a limited vocabulary. The Police Benevolent Association was once again working at full throttle to do all sorts of wonderful things for the community. Toys for tots, Christmas baskets for the less fortunate, visits by Santa, ice skating adventures, trips to the zoo. And they were delivering gifts to the old folks in the nursing homes and to the veterans tucked away in wards. Celino had perfected his presentation. Luther had heard it before. To help defray the costs of their worthy projects this year, the Police Benevolent Association had once again put together a handsome calendar for next year, one that again featured some of its members in action shots as they served the people. Treen on cue whipped out Luther's calendar, unrolled it, and flipped the rather large sheets as Celino did the play-by-play. For January, it was a traffic cop with a warm smile waving little kindergartners across the street. For February, it was a cop even beefier than Treen helping a stranded motorist change a tire. Somehow, in the midst of the effort, the policeman had managed to smile. For March, it was a rather tense scene at a nighttime accident with lights flashing all around and three men in blue conferring with frowns. Luther admired the photos and artwork without a word as the months marched along. What about the leopard print briefs, he wanted to ask, or the steam room, or the lifeguard with just a towel around his waist? 3 years earlier, the PBA had succumbed to trendier tastes and published a calendar filled with photos of its leaner and younger members, all clad in virtually nothing, half grinning goofily at the camera, the other half straining with the tortured I-hate-modeling veneer of contemporary fashion. Practically R-rated, a big story about it made the front page. Quite a brouhaha erupted overnight. The mayor was incensed as complaints flooded City Hall. The director of the PBA got fired. The undistributed calendars were pulled and burned while the local TV station recorded it live. Nora kept theirs in the basement, where she secretly enjoyed it all year. The beefcake calendar was a financial disaster for all concerned, but it created more interest the following Christmas. Sales almost doubled. Luther bought one every year, but only because it was expected. Oddly, there was no price attached to the calendars, at least not to the ones delivered personally by the likes of Celino and Treen. Their personal touch cost something more, an additional layer of goodwill that people like Luther were expected to fork over simply because that was the way it was done. It was this coerced, above-the-table bribery that Luther hated. Last year he'd written a check for $100 to the PBA, but not this year. When the presentation was over, Luther stood tall and said, "I don't need one." Celino cocked his head to one side as if he'd misunderstood. Treen's neck puffed out another inch. Celino's face turned into a smirk. "You may not need one," the smirk said, "but you'll buy it anyway." "Why's that?" he said. "I already have calendars for next year." That was news to Nora, who was biting a fingernail and holding her breath. "But not like this," Treen managed to grunt. Celino shot him a look that said, "Be quiet." "I have two calendars in my office and two on my desk," Luther said. "We have one by the phone in the kitchen. My watch tells me precisely what day it is, as does my computer. Haven't missed a day in years." "We're raising money for crippled children, Mr. Crank," Celino said, his voice suddenly soft and scratchy. Nora felt a tear coming. "We give to crippled children, officer," Luther shot back. "Through the United Way and our church and our taxes, we give to every needy group you can possibly name." "You're not proud of your policeman?" Treen said roughly, no doubt repeating a line he'd heard Celino use on others. Luther caught himself for a second and allowed his anger to settle in, as if buying a calendar was the only measure of his pride in the local police force, as if forking over a bribe in the middle of his living room was proof that he, Luther Crank, stood solidly behind the boys in blue. "I paid $1,300 in city taxes last year," Luther said, his eyes flashing hot and settling on young Treen, "a portion of which went to pay your salary. Another portion went to pay the firemen, the ambulance drivers, the school teachers, the sanitation workers, the street cleaners, the mayor and his rather comprehensive staff, the judges, the bailiffs, the jailers, all those clerks down at City Hall, all those folks down at Mercy Hospital. They do a great job. You, sir, do a great job. I'm proud of all our city employees. But what's a calendar got to do with anything?" Of course, Treen had never had it put to him in such a logical manner.